Yeah, I think in the class we probably have about 7 or 8, and I think we have four upper modes.
Yeah. Okay, why don't we go ahead and get started?
Good morning. This is the fourth lecture of adaptive signal processing. Today we're going to finish off chapter 3 by talking about linear prediction. It's a topic we talked about last time. Minimum mean squared error, but we talked about it in a more general sense last time. This time around, we're going to talk very specifically about how this is applied to modeling time series, and hopefully we'll fill in some of the detail from the last lecture where we talked about things in a more general sense. So today we're going to talk about the linear prediction model. We're going to talk about the autocorrelation and the covariance method. We're going to talk about the Durbin recursion, which is also based on something called the Levinson recursion. And then we'll talk about how to interpret this in terms of digital filtering, spectral modeling, and inverse filtering and such. There's a number of good resources available for this information. A couple of my other courses that we teach this stuff in, are available, and a few of the textbooks we talked about, and MATLAB tool if you're interested in how some of this works in MATLAB. And over here we're showing a couple examples. This is a spectral matching application, which we'll show how that's done today. And this is an application from geophysics deconvolution. The textbook goes into geophysics applications in a little bit more detail. And I'll leave you to read that on your own. It's fairly straightforward material. So let's first talk about the linear prediction model. Consider a pth order linear prediction model, and we're going to define that as the signal x of n is going to be approximated. So the approximated signal we're going to call x hat of n is going to be a weighted sum of previous samples of x of n. So we have x of n minus I. Now we've included a term n0 here because in some applications, particularly in geophysics applications, there's a certain group delay that's known to the application, and you want to offset your signal by that amount since you know that it's going to take a certain number of seconds for your signal to return. For example, if you're dealing with propagation through water or propagation through land or maybe propagation over a satellite link, it doesn't make sense to use this model on samples that are near in time because you know that the whole signal is going to be delayed by a certain amount of time. So in the textbook they use, since the textbook is talking about this material from a geophysics application standpoint, they use this term N0. But without loss of generality, we're going to assume N0 is equal to zero. And then the derivations will look a lot like what you see in most standard textbooks on the topic of linear prediction. We're going to spend some time today talking about this in terms of a filter implementation. So here we have the signal, here we have the prediction filter, and what comes out is the estimated signal. Our desired signal is the original signal, because what we're trying to do here is develop a model for the original signal. And the error term then will be the difference between these two. Now we'll expand on this view of the prediction model later today, and by the end of today you'll see that linear prediction is in fact nothing more than a linear filtering problem. So from last time we defined the prediction error as a difference between these two signals. So our prediction error is going to be xn minus x hat of n, and using our prediction model we can write that as x of n minus the sum from I equals 1 to p of a sub I, x of n minus I. So our estimate for the signal is formed from a combination of previous samples of the signal. And that's why it's called linear, because you're taking basically a weighted sum of previous samples. We can define an objective function. Last time we talked in general about an objective function, which was the expectation of the squared error, otherwise known as the energy of the error signal. We can write that as x of n minus x hat of n quantity squared, and we can take then the expectation of that. Now, we derived last time a general form for the linear prediction solution, but what I'd like to do today, just to reinforce that, is to go through the derivation in a manner that you'll find in a typical DSP class. Some of you may have seen this in your intro to DSP class. So I just thought it'd be useful to repeat that derivation and show you how it works with actual signals involved. So here we have the expectation of x of n minus the sum of a sub I, x of n minus I. We have that quantity squared. Well, we can simply go ahead and square these terms. So we're going to have x squared of n minus twice the cross product plus the last term squared. But we can also, with the expectation, distribute that amongst the three terms, since the expectation of a sum is equal to the sum of the expectations. So we can write the expectation of x squared of n minus the expectation of 2 times x of n times the sum of a sub I, x of n minus I, plus the expectation of the last term squared, the sum of a sub I, x of n minus I. Now this first term we'll leave alone because that's fairly compact. What does this first term tell us about the signal? The expectation of x squared of n, what does that represent?
Energy and power.
That's essentially the energy or the power of the signal. We talked last time about the orthogonality principle, and we'll see how that works in a moment, but this second term, the expectation of 2 times x of n times the sum of a sub I, x of n minus I, well, the sum is with respect to I, so we can move the x of n inside the summation, and we can write, and we can pull the constant 2 out, so we can write the expectation of the sum of a sub I, x of n minus I. Now that should, I think you can understand why we're trying to do this. This starts to look like a very familiar term. The third term, for the moment, we'll just carry down and write as the expectation of that sum squared. Now, we'll carry this next term down. Here we have the expectation of a sum, but the sum is with respect to I, and the expectation is with respect to n. So we can interchange the orders of those, and we can also pull this constant outside of the expectation, so we can write minus 2 times the sum from I equals 1 to p of a sub I, times the expectation of x of n minus I, for that middle term. And then we'll carry the other two terms down. So this is beginning to look somewhat familiar. We're going to go ahead and differentiate it with respect to a particular coefficient so that we can find the optimal values of a. So to find the optimal values of a, we need to differentiate the function and find the values of a that produce a maximum. Or a minimum in the air, rather. So we're going to differentiate this equation with respect to one of the coefficients, which we will call a sub l, which means the derivatives of all the other coefficients are essentially going to be zero. So we differentiate this term with respect to a sub l. Well, we can write that as the derivative of a sum is essentially the sum of the derivatives. So we can write that as a derivative of this first term minus twice the derivative of the second term plus the derivative of the third term. And we'll go ahead and set that equal to zero. Now, what can we say about the derivative of this term with respect to a sub l? It's what?
Zero.
Why? It has nothing to do with a sub l. So that term goes away. That's straightforward. What about the derivative of this term with respect to a sub l? Well, if you think about this, this is just a 1 plus e times a 2 plus e plus a 3 and so forth. Only one of the coefficients, when I is equal to l, is going to be non-zero. And that'll be the term a sub l, e of x of n minus l. And the derivative of a sub l times that expectation, well, the derivative of a sub l with respect to a sub l is just 1. So this term reduces to minus 2 times the expectation of x of n minus l. Now the third term is a quadratic term. So this is essentially a function squared. So the derivative of this is going to be twice the function times the derivative of what's inside the parentheses. Well, again, we have a sum from I equals 1 to P, so only one of those coefficients is going to be non-zero, and that's going to be when I is equal to L. So we'll have the derivative of A sub L, X sub N minus L, with respect to A sub L, and that will just be X sub N minus L. So we have twice this times X sub N minus L is equal to 0. Now, we can rearrange terms a little bit. We can move this term to the other side. We can throw away the 2. And we can write that the expectation of this a sub I, x sub n minus I, times x sub n minus L is equal to the expectation of x sub n times x sub n minus L. Now, here we can again interchange the order of summation and expectation, because the expectation is with respect to n, and the summation is with respect to I. So we can write the sum from I equals 1 to P of A sub I times the expectation of X sub N minus I times X sub N minus L. And that's equal to the expectation of X sub N minus L. So this should begin to look familiar. We essentially saw the same thing last time in a more general sense. So we can define a covariance function C of I and J, which is equal to the expectation of X sub N minus I times X sub N minus J. And you can see the reason we're going to do that is because each one of these terms can be written as a covariance. This is the covariance of I comma L, and this is the covariance of 0 comma L. So we can then rewrite our prediction equation as the sum from I equals 1 to P of A sub I times C of I comma L, and that's equal to C of 0 comma L. Now, this equation is also known as the Ewell-Walker equation, and its solution produces what we refer to as the covariance method for linear prediction. Linear prediction was developed in a number of different areas. So it's interesting that some of these concepts have multiple names. Last time we referred to the general form of this equation as a normal equation. It's also been referred to as the Ewell-Walker equation when it was derived in this context of a time series. So this is essentially a family of equations, because the unknown variable is A sub I, and there's P of those from I equals 1 to P. And it's in terms of these weights, the covariance coefficients. So we can actually go ahead and write out this system of equations, because that'll make it more apparent how it can be written in terms of linear algebra. So the first term here, if we look at the case where L is equal to 1, we have A sub 1 times C of 1 comma 1, plus a sub 2 times c of 2 comma 1, and so forth, out to a sub p times c of p comma 1. And that's equal to c of 0 comma 1. We can then repeat that for l equals 2 and write a1 of c of 1 comma 2 plus a2 of c of 2 comma 2 and so forth is equal to a sub p of c of p comma 2. And that's equal to c of 0 comma 2. And we can then continue that out to L is equal to P and write A1 C of 1 comma P plus A2 C of 2 comma P and so forth out to C of 0 comma P. Now, we can rewrite this set of P equations in matrix form as a covariance matrix times a vector is equal to a vector. And then if we can do that, we can easily solve for the prediction coefficients as the inverse of this covariance matrix times this covariance vector. Last time, we derived this in a general form, but now you're seeing it sort of in a specific case. In this equation, there's three important quantities. There's the coefficient vector, A1 through AP. There's the covariance matrix, C11, C21, C21, C1, and so there's the covariance terms essentially. So yeah, I think I got the indexing backwards on this, but this is actually the covariance matrix is symmetric. So C21 is equal to C12 because that's just the sum of x of n minus I, x of n minus j, and that's obviously symmetric. So this is a symmetric matrix, and that has some nice properties that we'll discuss in a moment. So here I should actually go ahead and write this as a symmetric matrix, but from inspection we can see that the diagonal term consists essentially of the correlation, though, and the off-diagonal terms are the covariances separated by these indices. And last time we talked about the fact that if the signal is stationary, we can replace these correlation coefficients with autocorrelation functions. But the covariance method is often called the pure least squares solution because it's, if you will, the mathematically correct solution for the signal. Now, what that means is that this has some important implications when you have finite amounts of data. And we talked about last time that this is typically done in the context of a time domain windowing type operation. So these covariances are going to be computed over finite limits. And when you have finite limits, then some of the differences between these terms, especially at the edges of the window, become somewhat meaningful. So if we look at, for example, this diagonal term, what is the difference between C11 and C22? Well, C11 is the sum of x of n minus 1 times x of n minus 1. C22 is the sum of x of n minus 2 times x of n minus 2, right? So you might think, well, these two terms are the same because they're simply summing the signal times itself over the window. But, of course, there's one subtle distinction, which is their time shifted, that summation is time shifted by one sample. And depending on how you deal with things at the edge of the frame, that one sample could make a difference. So typically what we do is we constrain these sums to operate over the same data within the frame, and that makes these diagonal terms equal to one another. But if you allow the sums to extend beyond the edges of the frames, then these summations will be slightly different. So C is a covariance matrix, which means it has some special properties. And I noticed, by the way, when we're looking at the notes here, these secondary bullets are not being indented properly. But if you look at this under 2007, it'll render properly. So the covariance matrix is symmetric, and that in itself is a very important property because symmetric matrices can be analyzed in terms of their stability fairly simply. Under what conditions does the inverse of the symmetric covariance matrix exist? We talked about that last time. If you have a symmetric matrix, that actually you can relate the existence of its inverse to its eigenvalues. And I'm seeing some blank faces. So you need to review some of your basic matrix linear algebra. But the symmetric matrix, the conditions under which this matrix exists are important. Now, they're in practice, one of the reasons people do not one of the reasons people don't like the covariance method is because the matrix can, in fact, become ill-conditioned. Ill-conditioned means it's very close to being singular. And there's a couple ways that happens. One way that happens is if your order of your model is much, much larger than the order of the signal. So let's say the signal that you're analyzing is a sum of sine waves, which we'll see later can be represented as a four coefficient LP model. If you analyze that with something like a 12th order model, you have more coefficients than you need for the data. And the matrix will be singular because it will be overdetermined, and some of the rows and columns will be dependent on one another, and therefore when you try to do the inverse, the matrix will be singular. So one way that this inverse doesn't exist is when your model order is too high. Now later we'll see that's with the autocorrelation method, there's a very nice way to determine that, and we'll see why how that happens in a moment. But even if the model order is not too high, sometimes if you have certain types of noise in the signal, you can run into a situation where the matrix becomes ill-conditioned or close to being singular. If you've ever inverted matrices on computers, you're also familiar with the issues related to that. Matrices, even though they may technically not be singular, sometimes when you invert them on a computer using various algorithms, they get very close to being singular, and because of computational noise, they go singular on you. So it would be nice to have a method where we didn't have to worry so much about whether the covariance matrix was singular. Now, in the early days of linear prediction, you know, there was a lot of theoretical work done and a lot of heated debates about covariance method versus autocorrelation method. But generally, in practice, you prefer algorithms that are very stable and do not have problems with singularity. So we would like a much more efficient way to do this linear prediction than the covariance matrix. And that method's known as the autocorrelation method, which I'll talk about in a moment. But even with the covariance matrix being symmetric, we can actually compute the LP coefficients using a fast inversion technique known as the Kolesky decomposition. In this decomposition, you essentially factor the covariance matrix into upper and lower triangular matrices, and then you can derive a recursion for this computation. So we don't actually have to do a matrix inversion, which is computationally very expensive and also typically requires floating point precision. When linear prediction was first being introduced, all that were available for DSP type applications were fixed point processors. So people were very interested in methods that could be easily implemented on fixed point processors. Even today, we're still interested in that. So if the covariance method can be done using something called the Kolesky decomposition, you can read more about that in some of the references I provided with the notes. Last time, however, we talked about if we assume that the signal is stationary, then the covariance becomes what we essentially a correlation, because the diagonal terms C11, C22, and so forth are equal, because it doesn't matter where you take this window, you get the same summation. And we can write the elements of the matrix in terms of not I and J, but just the difference between I and J. So the correlation matrix essentially becomes autocorrelation value for zero for the diagonal, and each of these elements is just a function of the difference between I and J. So the covariance matrix becomes what's called an autocorrelation matrix. We have R0, R1 to RP minus 1, R1, R0 to RP minus 2, and so forth. And it's a symmetric matrix, so R1 here is equal to R1 here, RP here. This should be RP minus 1 here. RP minus 2 up. This should be RP minus 1. So this is a matrix which has an order. It's a P by P matrix. And it's in terms of the autocorrelation function. And then similarly, this vector for the right-hand side is just the autocorrelation at value 1 through value P. So this method is known as the autocorrelation method. This matrix is symmetric, but it is also what's called topless. Topless is a term that applies to a family of matrices. In this context, all that it really means is that the value, any value of the matrix, is merely a function of the difference in the two indices. And that property makes it very easy to invert this matrix efficiently. And we'll see shortly, the Durbin algorithm is one algorithm that's used to do that. But what else do we know about correlation matrices in terms of inverses and stability? You probably studied this, either, I would hope, in your like random processes class or something like that. So correlation matrices are even more stable than covariance matrices. Their inverse is guaranteed to exist as long as the matrix is not overdetermined. So there's a stronger condition on the inverse of the matrix, the existence of the inverse, than in a covariance case. And again, you can relate that to the eigenvalues of the matrix. So note that the covariance method requires P times P minus 1 over 2 unique values for the matrix, and P values for this associated vector. A fast algorithm exists for computing these values of the covariance function, which is called the factored covariance algorithm. There's a link to it in the notes. I won't go through it in class, but it essentially exploits the fact that covariance functions, you take x of n minus I times x of n minus j, that term appears in many different places in the computation, so you can reuse those calculations and you can derive a algorithm that essentially tries to only compute the lags that you need once and then sum them all together in a kind of fast way. The autocorrelation method, on the other hand, only requires P plus 1 values of the correlation function. We need R0 through RP. And the entire calculation is built out of these P plus 1 values of the correlation function. And that's interesting because that tells you that you take these P plus 1 values of the correlation function and you produce P linear prediction coefficients. You can actually think of this as 1 plus P coefficients. So actually it's P plus 1 coefficients to P plus 1. So the LP model and the autocorrelation model are essentially synonymous because they describe their two alternate representations to describe the signal. And in a few slides, we'll see that you can actually go back and forth between these two using a transformation. So that's the interesting thing about linear prediction, is that it's a very nice way to describe a signal, and whether you describe it as autocorrelation coefficients, as linear prediction coefficients, it doesn't really matter. This is one and the same description. It's a description of it's a description of the signal under particular constraints, and we'll see that in a moment when we talk about minimum phase. But first, let's go back and look at the error term a little bit more closely, because we can get a lot of insight into the error term. So if you recall our expression for the prediction error energy, we have J was equal to the expectation of E of n squared, and we wrote that as x of n minus the sum of A sub I, x of n minus I squared. Now, if you take our expression for the optimal value of the coefficients, C inverse times C, and you make that substitution, and then you work through the algebra, you can actually show that the error term can be written in terms of the autocorrelation function and the covariance method. So if you go, if you make that substitution and do the work, what you'll show for the autocorrelation method is that the error term is R0 minus the sum from I equals 1 to P of A sub I times R of I. Similarly, if you do that for the covariance method, you can show that it's just equal to C00 minus the sum of A sub I, C of 0, comma, this should be, I don't know why that's K, that should be 0, comma I. Now these relations are significant because they show that the error obeys the same linear prediction equation that applies to the signal. And this result has two interesting implications. One of them is that missing values of the correlation function can be calculated using this relation under certain assumptions. And this was a result that was developed using, actually derived directly from the principle of maximum entropy. I'll comment on that a little bit later in the lecture as well. But this was of great interest to geophysics applications, because in geophysics applications, it's more common that sometimes when you collect the data, you'll actually be missing values of the correlation function. And these equations provided a way to interpolate values of the correlation function. It also shows that the autocorrelation function shares many properties with the linear prediction model. And one of them that we'll talk about in a moment when we look at this, when we interpret linear prediction as a filterer, is this principle of minimum phase. What is the difference when you take a signal and compute the autocorrelation function? And you learn this back in random processes. What is the, is the autocorrelation function a unique description of the signal? Is it a one-to-one mapping from the signal to the autocorrelation function? If I give you the autocorrelation function, can you derive the signal exactly? How many of you have had random processes? Two, three, four, five. Okay, and the answer is? How many of you had DSP? One, two, three, four, five, right? Everyone's had DSP, right? Okay, so the answer is? So let me ask this, let's go back to signals and systems. When you take a signal and you compute its power spectrum, how do you compute that? What is the relationship between a signal and its power spectrum? Not its spectrum, its power spectrum.
First of all, the correlation, then you use Fourier transform.
Suppose you knew, you didn't know about autocorrelation, how would you compute the power spectral density? And you're too advanced. You shouldn't be asking this. They should be answering this. Yeah, go ahead.
Is the power spectrum, is it sun or the energy should be equal?
Power and power spectral density, energy, right? These are kind of the same thing. Power spectral density is a representation of the energy of the power of a signal, right? Suppose we talk about the power flowing through a resistor in a circuit. Suppose I tell you that the input signal is like sine omega t, one sine omega t, and I tell you that the power dissipated in this resistor is, let's say, 1 watt, for whatever reason. If I then ask you, what's the power of sine omega t plus theta for any value of theta, what are you going to tell me the power is? Does the power flowing through that resistor change if you change the phase of that sine wave? And the answer is no. Your toaster gets hot whether it's sine omega t plus 45 or sine omega t plus 90, right? The power is independent of phase. So when you compute the power spectral density from the signal, how do you compute that using a Fourier transform? You take the magnitude of the Fourier transform and square it, and you throw away the phase. Okay, now, how also can you compute the power spectral density? You can take the correlation of the signal and take its Fourier transform. So the autocorrelation function, or the autocorrelation representation of the signal, is essentially a representation of the signal where you throw away the phase. It's what's called a minimum phase representation. Now, what's the implication of that throwing away the phase? If the signal is in fact not minimum phase, it can have, two signals can have the same power spectral density, all that differs is the phase. If the signal is minimum phase, it has a certain property, which I'm trying to draw out of you. But suppose the signal is not minimum phase, what is its relation to the minimum phase version of that signal? What does it mean to be minimum phase? What does that mean in terms of the temporal characteristics of the signal, the time domain? Minimum phase means that the signal is maximally compact in the time domain. It's the most compact representation of the signal in the time domain, which means it's the version of the signal, of all the signal that could have a particular power spectral density, it's the version of the signal that's most concentrated around the origin, around time equals zero. It's sort of the maximally compact in time version of the signal. Linear prediction, because it uses the autocorrelation function, essentially produces a minimum phase model of the signal. If the signal is not minimum phase, it will still produce the minimum phase model of the signal. So that's significant. Now, phase in many applications is not important to us. For example, if you're building a speech recognition system, or you're building a noise reduction system, or these kinds of things, you tend not to worry about phase. But phase is important in some other applications. In acoustics, for example, phase is very important. If you're studying the way my voice reverberates around this room, you're going to be very interested in phase. If you're trying to tune the surround sound on your speakers at home, what you're essentially doing is playing with phase. Autocorrelation is synonymous with a minimum phase description. So we see that the linear prediction solution produces a minimum phase model for the signal. Now we'll sort of continue on this thread in a moment. Recall that our expression for the air signal, again, was just x of n minus the sum of a sub I x of n minus I. Now, if I take the z transform of this equation, I can write the z transform of e of n as e of z. I can write the z transform of this term as x of n minus the z transform of x of n minus the sum of a sub I x of n minus I. Well, the z there's a bracket missing here. The z transform of x of n is just what we'll call x of z. The z transform of a weighted sum is just the weighted sum of the z transforms. So we can write this as the sum from I equals 1 to p of a sub I times the z transform of x of n minus I. For a linear time invariant system, we can write the z transform of x of n minus I as what? This is just a time delay property. So we have the z transform of x of n minus I is just z to the power minus I times x of z. It's a basic property of the Z transform. So we can then write this term as x of z times the quantity 1 minus the sum of a sub I z to the minus I. Now this is rather remarkable because this says that we can view the linear prediction process as a filtering process. We can write that E of z is equal to x of z times a of z, where a of z is equal to this polynomial. And we can, of course, invert this process and generate the original signal from the error signal. So we can take x of n, filter it through a of z, and produce E of n. We can then take that E of n, process it through the inverse of this filter, and produce x of n. And without any loss of information, we can recover x of n exactly. And in fact, this will work for any values of the filter, but with linear prediction, we're doing really kind of two things. One is we're computing these optimal coefficients of the filter, and the second, from the orthogonality principle that we talked about last time, we're trying to make this error signal as white as possible, have as little correlation as possible. Now there's a couple, for this to work, however, there's a couple things we have to worry about. The first thing we want to worry about is, well, A of Z, this is just a finite impulse response filter. Finite impulse response filters are composed of zeros, poles, or both. Finite impulse response filters, if you go back to your basic DSP, are known as what types of filters in terms of poles and zeros? They're an all-zero filter. Under what conditions is an all-zero filter minimum phase? Very good, very good. So we know the concept of the unit circle is very important with the Z transform. If the zeros lie inside the unit circle, A of Z is a minimum phase filter. Well, we've already said that the linear prediction solution, because it uses the autocorrelation, is a minimum phase model. So we see now by using the correlation computation, we're forcing this filter to be minimum phase, to have all of its zeros inside the unit circle. So this is a minimum phase representation of the signal. Secondly, for this to work, this filter has to be stable. Well, what is required for 1 over A of Z to be stable? 1 over A of Z is what kind of filter? Poles, zeros, mixed. It's all pole because A of Z is all zero, so 1 over A of Z has to be all pole. For an all pole filter to be stable, what has to be true? What does stable mean? Stable means its impulse response is bounded. If it's marginally stable, its impulse response oscillates. If it's absolutely stable, its impulse response decays to zero as time goes to infinity. For that to be true, what can we say about the locations of the poles of that filter? They should be within the unit circle. So for this to work, we want this filter to be stable. The covariance method does not guarantee the linear prediction filter to be stable. It's what's called, again, it's often referred to as the pure least square solution, because the covariance method is capable of modeling a signal which is unstable, but the poles of the filter for that signal can fall outside the unit circle. However, the autocorrelation method guarantees the filter to be stable. And that's another reason why the autocorrelation method is very popular, because you're computing the coefficients under the constraint that the filter be stable. So it always gives you a stable filter, which is really nice if you're building some kind of analysis system that's going to operate in real time in a hands-off manner. You just want the system to run and to do the right thing, and autocorrelation method will do that. Covariance method, it's a little bit more difficult to use because it can produce an unstable filter. So we see now two important characteristics of the linear prediction filter when it's computed using the autocorrelation method. One is that the filter will be stable, and two, that the filter is minimum phase. So let's look at what these prediction errors actually look like, because we can gain some insight into how this works. So to the right here, we have some examples of linear prediction error for voice speech signals. Here we have the signal, here we have the prediction error. And here we have several signals, different types of vowels, and here we have the prediction error. Now, I don't want to go too much into the speech signal itself, but I wanted to point out that you get a lot of insight into what linear prediction is doing. In regions where the signal here is kind of oscillating, we see the prediction error is very low. But we also see that the prediction error is very high at these regularly spaced intervals. This is because at these points in time, the signal is being generated, a voice speech signal, like a vowel, is actually being generated by impulse functions that I sort of generate from my lungs. My lungs go through my vocal cords vibrate, etc. At these points, these regularly spaced points, this is where you're actually exciting the vocal tract with a push of air. That's the point at which the signal is least predictable by this linear prediction model. So the error is very high. But once you get past that point, the signal essentially rings. It oscillates like a damped oscillator. And then this all-pole model is a very good model of the signal. So you see that the error becomes very low. There's also unvoiced sounds, sounds like S, S, and Sh. These are very noise-like. The linear prediction model does a very good job of modeling these kinds of sounds because they can be very nicely modeled as white noise plus an all-pole filter. So the point where the prediction error peaks are points in the signal where the signal is least predictable by a linear prediction model. In the case of voice speech, this relates to the manner in which the signal is produced. Even though we get these large error spikes, remember that if I take this signal and I pass it through the linear prediction filter, I will get back the original speech signal. Well, speech compression and synthesis systems exploit the linear prediction model as a first-order attempt to remove redundancy from the signal. The process that I just described was the way we tried to code speech in the early days when linear prediction was developed. We took the signal, we processed it through a linear prediction model, we quantized this error signal using some standard quantization or compression techniques, and we were able to go from 64,000 bits per second down to about 2,000 bits per second. Because we were transmitting the prediction coefficients. We were transmitting the coefficients of this model and some information about the residual signal. That synthesis technique, what was called linear predictive coding of speech, revolutionized the field of digital signal processing back in the 1970s. Several computer toys were developed in the early days. You might have heard of Speak and Spell from Texas Instruments. I used to work for the group that produced that. That technology you actually see today. While I was doing my notes last night, I saw this commercial from Leapfrog where they were showing some of these electronic books. Leapfrog actually still uses that technology. Your cell phones today use a variant of that technology called code-excited linear prediction, which is it still does a linear predictive model. It actually does two linear predictive models, but it has a very clever way of encoding the residual signal so that you get very high quality speech at 8 kilobits per second or even 4 kilobits per second. So this gave rise to what we call sort of the analysis synthesis systems, because you could compute the LP model and then you could synthesize speech from it. Another thing that this technology enabled was the technology called text-to-speech, the ability to type a string of text on a computer and have the computer synthesize that into a voice. When you hear computer-generated voice on the computer, like on a telephone, when you call a voice response system, and it has that robotic sound to it, that's actually using this kind of technology. Now, another thing to notice about this analysis, since it's just a linear filtering process, what happens if I double the amplitude of the input signal? What happens to the linear prediction coefficients? What do you think happens to the linear prediction coefficients? You'll recall that the coefficients were based on the autocorrelation function. And it was actually the inverse of the autocorrelation matrix times the autocorrelation vector. If I double the amplitude of the signal, what happens to the values of those correlations? They will be squared because they're all essentially xn times xn minus I. So if I double the value of the signal, the correlations will quadruple, they'll increase by factor 4. But since I'm computing R inverse times R, that's going to essentially wash out because you're essentially dividing by the power of the signal. So the linear prediction model is independent of the energy of the input signal. This means that no matter what the energy level of the signal is, you'll get the same linear prediction coefficients. Okay, well, you could say, a good thing or a bad thing. That's a good thing, because whether I speak loud or soft, you can use the same coefficients. All you have to do is change the energy. It's a bad thing because now I have to encode, it's not really a bad thing, but it just means that I have to now transmit the energy of the signal along with the coefficients if I want to reconstruct the original signal. Similarly, we talked about the fact that the linear prediction filter is a minimum phase filter, which means even if x of n is not a minimum phase signal, the model that will be produced will be for the minimum phase equivalent of that signal. Now, that's not so bad, because all that means is the power spectral density is the same, whether x is minimum phase or not minimum phase. It just means that the phase of the linear prediction filter will not be an exact replica of the signal unless the signal is a minimum phase signal to begin with. Now, again, that's in some applications like speech processing, by and large, that's a good thing. In some applications, like acoustics, that's a bad thing because the phase becomes very important. So the neat thing about all of this, and this is why I hope you saw this in your DSP class. When I teach DSP, I usually teach a lecture on this. Linear prediction can be viewed of as nothing more than a digital filtering operation. It's just the coefficients of the filter have been optimized to minimize the mean squared error. So they're sort of special coefficients. So let's now go back and talk about the process by which we compute these coefficients. There are several efficient algorithms to compute the linear prediction coefficients without doing a matrix inverse. Matrix inverses are very difficult to do on computers. If you don't believe that, wait till you start processing lots of real data. So we typically try to avoid matrix inverses at all costs. One of the most popular efficient algorithms for doing this is known as the Durbin recursion. Now, in the textbook, they have very nice in the appendix, they discuss the Levinson algorithm and the Durbin algorithm. There's actually probably half a dozen of these kinds of algorithms to do this computation recursively. The Durbin algorithm has been the most popular because it gives us a lot of insight into how this process works. The Durbin recursion, and again, the fact that this recursion exists is very simply just a function of the fact that the correlation matrix is topless. The Durbin recursion begins by setting E equal to R of zero, the energy of the error energy of the first of the zeroth order predictor is just equal to the energy of the signal. We then compute these intermediate coefficients called reflection coefficients. We compute K sub I as R of I minus the sum of A, the predictor coefficients from the previous stage of the iteration, times R of I minus J. So this is an iteration where for each value of I, we're going to use the previous values of A that we computed. And then once you compute this term, once you compute the K, then A sub J superscript I. So that the A sub J at the ith order of the iteration is going to be equal to K sub I. Then you go back and you compute the new values of A from the old values of A times these K times the old values of A. And then you go up and you update the energy, and then you go back and repeat. So let me explain again in the flow of this. You start off with a zeroth order model and you compute K1. K1 gives you A1, which is the first order model. Then you use A1 and K1 to compute A1 and A to compute K2, and then use K2 to compute A2. Then you go back and compute a new A1. Now you have A1 and A2. Then you compute on K3, then you compute an A3, then you go back and compute A1, A2. So it's sort of it's a very interesting recursion. You may not have seen this kind of a thing before, but these are actually kind of common recursions for this type of thing. The intermediate coefficients, Ks, are referred to as reflection coefficients. Note that to compute the pth order model, all orders from 1 to p are computed. This is a really nice property, because you can actually watch the model unfold as you do this computation. This recursion is significant for several reasons. First of all, it tells us that the error energy is going to decrease as long as these k's are less than 1. And that's something we talked about last time, that the error, as you increase the order of the predictor of the model, the error energy will decrease. And it decreases at the rate of 1 minus k sub I squared. There's a one-to-one mapping between the R's, the K's, and the A's. So even though the prediction model uses A's, we can actually describe the prediction model either in terms of the autocorrelation function or these reflection coefficients. These are interchangeable. You can transform between the R's, the K's, and the A's without any loss of information. Now, you can show, and we won't show this today, but again, this is a consequence of the autocorrelation method guaranteeing stability. You can show that a necessary and sufficient condition for the filter to be stable is that these K's be bounded by 1. And that's why, one of the reasons why this Durbin recursion is popular, this is actually a way to check if an all-pole filter is stable. Instead of finding the poles of that all-pole filter, which is very complicated, you can simply run the Durbin recursion, and if one of these k's becomes equal to 1 or greater than 1, you know the filter is marginally stable or unstable, and you terminate the recursion. The covariance method does not guarantee stability, so the covariance method will produce values of k which are greater than 1. So the autocorrelation matrix produces a stable filter, which means the k's are less than 1, which means, guess what? The error is going to go down with every stage of the iteration. So there's a very nice interrelationship between those concepts. So this got people to thinking, well, these reflection coefficients, these sound a lot like the reflection coefficients from acoustics when you bounce a wave off of a surface, like when my voice reverberates off this wall. I can actually characterize that by the angle at which my sound wave hits the wall and the amount of energy that the wall reflects. The amount of energy that the wall reflects is encoded in what we call a reflection coefficient. And in fact, these reflection coefficients actually came from acoustic tube analysis, which was already well known at the time. So people got to thinking, well, maybe I could actually model signals like voice with these reflection coefficients, and I could actually model voice as a sequence of acoustic tubes, which is historically how we started looking at voice many years ago. With that insight, people started to ask a question, well, maybe this whole linear prediction process can just be thought of as a process of computing these reflection coefficients. And maybe I can compute these reflection coefficients directly. Itakura was the first one to show that, in fact, you can view the linear prediction process as a signal going into what's called a lattice filter. And if you compute the coefficients, the weights, of this digital filter using this equation, you will produce the exact same linear prediction coefficients that you got through the Durbin recursion or through the autocorrelation method. And the calculation for these coefficients involves just taking a dot product of what's called the forward error and the backward error. And divided by essentially a product of the two. Now, again, you know, we used to teach a lot about filter design way back when. In fact, before I was a graduate student, they taught a lot more about filter design. Active, passive, all these kinds of things. But lattice filters are very old, they're very well known, and they have very, you know, the properties of these filters are very well known. So the people who came up with this, of course, have, you know, said, aha, this is just like lattice filters that we've already seen. But lattice filters are interesting because people went one step further and said, well, maybe there's different ways I can compute the k's to arrive at different properties of these filters. And John Berg, in one of a really nice piece of work in the early 70s, he actually showed that this structure can be arrived at by assuming you want to model a spectrum with what's called a maximum entropy spectral model. You postulate a model such that the coefficients of that model satisfy the principle of maximum entropy, and then you can derive all these LP results, linear prediction results, as a consequence of that. This created a whole area of science called maximum entropy spectral estimation. This was the precursor to all these maximum entropy methods you've subsequently seen in signal processing. Very, very nice piece of work. And in fact, he showed that if you compute the reflection coefficients this way, take the dot product of the errors, but then you sum the errors on the bottom, it guarantees the reflection coefficients are bounded, so you always get a stable filter. And this was developed for geophysics applications where they were having trouble with stability. John McCool then came along in the mid-70s and showed that, in fact, there's many different ways you can combine these error terms to produce a family of linear prediction solutions, all with different constraints. And that was sort of a groundbreaking work because it began to unify all of this theory as just really a process of different functional forms for these computations. But people took this one step further and said, well, if this is a lattice filter, why can't I just compute these coefficients on a sample-by-sample basis? So they actually began computing these k's using a time recursive algorithm where the new value of k was the old value of k plus some epsilon, which was related to the derivative of the error. A sort of typical gradient search type algorithm. And they derived linear prediction models that now could be updated in order n, n being the length of the filter. So in p multiplications, you could actually update the coefficients of these filters. That was pretty groundbreaking. In fact, a lot of the modems that you used, well, you guys didn't use because you're too young, but if you remember, well, and you know, modem technology is very interesting to me because it's literally the history of DSP. Everything we've ever done in DSP is probably made into a modem at some point. We started with 60 baud modems before I was born. We now have, you know, 56K modems over telephone lines. Those modems use these time-adaptive lattice filters to estimate the parameters of the channel and to do channel equalization. When you hear those tones and you hear the modem syncing and all that, it's actually doing this algorithm. So the time recursive lattice filter based implementation of linear prediction gave rise to a whole bunch of recursive and time algorithms that were very powerful for adaptive filtering applications. And that's why I like to point out that in this course, now this is our first truly adaptive filter. This is a filter which can model a signal in real time using a very simple adaptation process. So let me say a couple more things about the autoregressive model. We've talked about the fact that 1 over A of Z is an all-pole model, and this is referred to as an autoregressive model because it's derived from an autocorrelation function. You may have seen filters like this in DSP. These are considered mixed models or ARMA models, autoregressive and moving average, because they have both zeros and poles. The LP model, if your signal was actually generated by this kind of a system, your LP model can actually model that, because you may recall that one pole can be modeled as lots of zeros. So whether the signal was all pole, all zero, or mixed, you can actually model it with an all pole filter, much like you do digital filter design. So even if the system has poles or zeros, the LP model is capable of approximating the system. Further, people have actually extended the time recursive formulations for linear prediction to actually estimate the coefficients of a model like this in real time. And there are different ways they do that. Sometimes they'll do that by first computing a all-pole model, then taking what's left and computing an all-zero model. You'll hear this sometimes referred to as a ladder filter implementation. But once people, you know, made these connections, they realized there's ways you can actually compute these coefficients of more complicated models. Now, the last sort of concept I want to introduce was the concept of spectral matching and blind deconvolution. Recall our expression for the energy, where the energy is a function of these coefficients. The LP filter becomes increasingly more accurate if you increase the order of the model. So let's think about what that means for a moment. That means as the model order gets larger, your model of the signal is going to get closer and closer to the signal. The error energy is going to go down. The frequency response of your model, 1 over A of Z, is going to get closer and closer to the frequency response of the signal. So here we show the FFT, the Fourier transform, of a signal, and we overlay on that the linear prediction model. And here we show a model of order 4. Now, that gives you a lot of insight into what the LP model is doing. The LP model is essentially a smoothed model of the spectrum. It does not have all these ups and downs of the ladder, the picket fence effect, as it's called, of the Fourier transform. Because it's a polynomial model, it's essentially a regression model of the spectrum. As you increase the order of the model, the LP model gets closer and closer to the true envelope of the spectrum. You can actually see this when you do this with computer tools. And in the limit, the LP model will approach the exact Fourier transform spectrum. So we can view this as a spectral matching process. It attempts to minimize the error equally across the entire spectrum. Now, that's a problem if your signal has a bandpass characteristic to it. This is actually telephone data. And with the telephone, there's some energy between about 3.4 hertz and kilohertz and 4 kilohertz that's attenuated. That causes a problem for the LP model because the LP model tries to model that at the expense of modeling the actual signal. So typically, if there's known variations in the spectrum, we actually try to remove those before we do the LP analysis. And two common things we do. One is we actually try to what's called preemphasize the signal. If the signal is sloped, we try to flatten it before we do the LP analysis. Secondly, if the signal has these bands that are dead, we try to either fill those in with noise or we do some mathematical manipulations like adding noise to the diagonal, the covariance matrix, to try to take away that effect. We won't go into that in great detail in this class, but that was a topic that was studied for many years when these techniques were first introduced. And the textbook talks a little bit about that. But this process of spectral matching is another reason why we often call this algorithm a blind deconvolution algorithm, because it's able to learn the characteristics of a signal with no knowledge of the signal. You feed it the signal, compute the coefficients, and it produces a model of the signal. Now, what we just covered, that used to be, there's entire books devoted to this topic. And so we've gone through a lot of concepts quickly, but I wanted today to give you a more concrete understanding of what minimum mean squared error approaches are all about. We talked about the fact that there's many interpretations and motivations for linear prediction. There's many implementations of the filter, including lattices. There are many representations for the coefficients, including predictor and reflection coefficients. We can actually take this a little further, and for signals that we know a lot about, like speech signals, we can actually take the linear prediction model and produce a physical model of the vocal tract from the coefficients. This is a process called inversion. And again, it was studied extensively in the 1970s because the vocal tract configuration is very important when you're trying to do something like speech recognition. So there are actually many other types of coefficients like Kestrel coefficients, log area ratios, and a bunch of other representations for the filter that we can use with this LP model. You can actually use linear prediction as a tool for many things. You can actually design a digital filter by drawing a spectrum and then running LP analysis on that spectrum and produce a filter. This is one way you do digital filter design. The filter can be estimated in batch mode or iteratively, as we briefly talked about. And that's why this is essentially an adaptive filter. Now, the last thing I wanted to leave you with, all this stuff ultimately ties together. One of the things that was shown when LP was first introduced was that if you view the estimation of the LP parameters as a pattern recognition problem, and you think of the estimation problem as a parameter estimation problem, like we studied last semester in pattern recognition, you can actually show that the LP solution is a maximum likelihood estimate of the parameters. So now we've not only tied all this mean squared error analysis together, now we've also tied this to maximum likelihood parameter estimation. And that's why, in fact, now people have gone further and said, well, you can actually show that I can estimate parameters of this filter using Bayesian techniques or using any other technique. And that's why in this course, I'm going to push you very hard to move beyond these traditional things like linear prediction, because I want to spend the last half of the course on modern technology, which is based on notions of Bayesian statistics and things like that. Because all this mean squared error stuff has been replaced by statistical methods. So that's why we're only spending a brief amount of time on linear prediction. Okay, well, almost everyone stayed awake. Only one person fell asleep. So that's not too bad. He sleeps in the... I'm used to it. He sleeps in my classes all the time. But he gets very high scores on the grades, so what can I say? On the exams, so what can I say? Okay.